from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, theoretical physicist and string theory pioneer thinker and author Brian Green will join us in studio for the hour. And it'll be an hour all about the world of string theory, multiverses, and parallel universes, and questions such as why are there maybe more Big Bangs than we think there were, and why time maybe doesn't exist as we perceive it. And we'll maybe even find out what your GPS system might be able to tell you about the theory of relativity. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. Coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Brian Green is a Harvard and Oxford Rhodes Scholar-educated physicist, formerly a professor at Cornell and presently professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia. He is author of the national bestsellers The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos and a children's book called Icarus at the Edge of Time, as well as having been host of the three-part PBS series The Elegant Universe, a pioneer in string theory, the unconfirmed theory that the universe has three and possibly as many as 11 dimensions and can be understood in terms of vibrating strings within different particles. He also helped develop the first World Science Festival in New York City and is widely acclaimed for taking ideas that can make the head spin and bringing them to the lay public and making us understand them, including making his mother understand them even. And he does that. He makes them accessible to a lay audience. His newest book, which does just that, is called The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. He's in studio with us for the second hour. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you.
Actually, I just saw you last night, so let's not pretend here. But string theory is a kind of pretending, maybe, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that. It's definitely at the cutting edge of knowledge. And when you're at the cutting edge, you don't know if what you're doing is right or wrong. That's, in some sense, what makes it exciting. And we are working hard to understand the theory well enough to make predictions, hopefully, that one day we will be able to test to know whether or not this is the correct unified theory.
Math, astronomy, and, well, a little operation in Geneva are the ways toward that.
Absolutely. It's a combination of all of those. We have to understand the mathematics better, and then we have to have powerful machines like the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, that can begin to probe some of the exotic realms where our theories really begin to flex their muscle and show different kind of phenomenon than other theories.
Give us, like I said, you're the champion in many ways of explaining things that are very difficult for some cerebellums or medulla oblongatas to get their head around. Your mother, for example, got a headache reading the first page of one of your books. If this was your mother listening, because we have a pretty wide audience, give us kind of that laid description of what string theory actually is, those vibrating strings. It is also called superstring theory.
Yes, well, there are two things that are good to have in mind when talking about string theory. One is, what's the goal? And the goal is to realize Einstein's dream that there might be one theory that would describe everything.
The unified field theory.
Unified theory. That's the goal. You know, one equation from which everything else might follow. That's the hope. Now, what is string theory? What is the proposal? Well, it turns out that by taking the old idea that particles making up matter are little tiny dots, you know, your high school teacher, when they were drawing electrons on the blackboard, they put a little tiny dot. Our view is that that dot might have something finer inside of it, which is a little tiny filament, a little tiny loop that vibrates like a string on a violin or a cello. And the idea is that the different vibrational patterns correspond to the different kinds of particles. A quark would be a little tiny string vibrating one way. An electron, a little tiny string vibrating a different way. And by this approach, we unify all of the particles, and in fact all of the forces, under this rubric of vibrating filaments. That's the basic idea.
And as you said on Stephen Colbert, we're just nothing but particles ourselves.
Yes, I did. Said that maybe a little too strongly.
I thought it was a good pickup line maybe or something along those lines. The sense, though, of string theory, which has become very prominent thanks to you and others like our own Leonard Susskind, who's been on this program at Stanford, has created a surprising amount of opposition. I mean, there's a loop theory now. There are people who, in fact, when Professor Susskind was last on, were posting things that sounded, pretty strong oppositionally.
Well, I think it's actually quite healthy when you have a deep problem and many people are approaching it from different angles. So absolutely, string theory is one attempt to find this unified theory. And by unified theory, the real puzzle, I should say, is putting together Einstein's view of gravity, which is his so-called general theory of relativity. We want to combine that with the law of the small things, molecules and atoms, which is quantum mechanics. So the goal is to put quantum mechanics and gravity together. String theory is one proposal for how you would do that, but there are other approaches. And I think it's great that there are different groups of people around the world pursuing different ways to try to achieve this singular goal of unifying all of the understanding under one theoretical framework.
Who was the wag who said to really understand quantum mechanics, you have to either be a genius or insane?
I think it was Bohr, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it was something like, if you don't get dizzy when you think about quantum mechanics, you've not properly understood it. It was something like that.
What about Brian Greene? Does he get dizzy with quantum mechanics?
I do get dizzy. I teach quantum mechanics now, even to undergraduates. I'm teaching an introductory quantum mechanics course. And I honestly tell you, I sit there preparing to give a lecture, and I say to myself, this stuff is crazy. How could this really be true? But then I take a step back and I think about the data. I think about the way that this theory has been confirmed. So it's such an exciting course to teach because you have these young minds that are open to these ideas and you are completely breaking down any preconceived notion of what reality is. Wow, it's just amazing.
Reality is mathematics.
Reality is mathematics and the expression of particular mathematics. And in quantum physics, that mathematics says that the world is governed by probabilities. I mean, from the time of Newton, even before, you would think that you can make definite statements about how the world is. Quantum mechanics comes along and says, that's just not correct. That's an approximation. When you get down to brass tacks, the most refined description is one of probabilities. You can say there's a 30% chance the electron is here, a 70% chance it's over there, and you can't do any better than that, according to quantum physics.
Well, in fact, Einstein discovered a few things that he thought couldn't possibly be that we have come into this new world of physics to understand. He was right about, though, in his world it didn't somehow fit.
That's right. He came upon with two colleagues, Podolsky and Rosen, something called the EPR paradox, the E as Einstein, where basically he was showing that according to the rules of quantum physics, something, say, in California and something else in New York could be in what we call an entangled state of existence, whereby performing a measurement on the particle in California, you instantaneously affect the one in New York. That's kind of crazy. In fact, Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. And when he came to this conclusion, he brought it to the quantum mechanicians and showed them, here's what your theory predicts, therefore you must give up your theory or say something's wrong with it. And most of them said, well, Einstein, this is kind of unexpected, but maybe that is how things work. Now, no one could do an experiment at that point to test it, but now, 70, 80 years later, we can test it, and that seems to be what really happens.
So we have not been able yet to test string theory or the idea, for example, that you write about in this new book of yours, that there are, you talk about New York and Los Angeles and different particles, that there are many universes out there, that there are, in fact, maybe parallel universes where you throw an egg up in the air and it just goes up rather than comes down.
Yeah. Yes, there are some unusual ideas emerging from cutting-edge research today, and perhaps the most spectacular, the most confounding, is the possibility that our universe is one of many universes. Now, in a way, this fits into a historical progression that we are familiar with, right? I mean, there was a time we thought the sun was the center, right? Well, actually, go back. We even thought the Earth was the center at one point. Then the sun was the center. And then we learned that there are many stars, and the sun is just one of many in our galaxy. Then we think the galaxy is at the center of it all, but now we learn there are 100 billion other galaxies. Maybe the same kind of demotion is happening, and our universe is just one of many universes.
In fact, speaking about 100 billion galaxies, they're moving away. They're expanding away from us. This is something else that Einstein quite couldn't digest, so to speak.
His mathematics of general relativity in about 1915, 1916 showed him that the universe could not be static. It had to be expanding or possibly contracting, but it couldn't stand still. He didn't like that idea, so he actually fiddled with the mathematics, introducing something called the cosmological constant, which was a way of making the math compatible with the universe that would be eternal and unchanging. 12 years later, Edwin Hubble was doing some very, very precise observations of distant galaxies with a powerful telescope and found that they are rushing away from us. The universe is expanding. And Einstein reportedly, I don't even know if it's really true, but he reportedly said, the cosmological constant, the greatest blunder of my life, because Certainly it's the case that he could have predicted that the universe was expanding from a mathematical calculation. I mean, think about that. He's doing a calculation on a piece of paper. He comes to a result that says that the universe is expanding. That's an amazing prediction from some calculations on a piece of paper, and it would have been correct.
Well, it's just one universe anyway, right?
Well, yes, that's right. So these multi-universe theories are correct. We can sort of say, oh, there's
just
one.
Maybe others contracting that we don't know about, right?
Well, in fact, that would be the case in some of these exotic approaches to the larger reality that our mathematics may be suggesting is out there.
Well, if indeed the galaxies are expanding, and that does seem to be the case, makes a whole different relationship to time. And you've said, for example, that we might be able to understand how to move ourselves into the future, but moving ourselves into the past, and as the galaxies go away from us, it's going to be more difficult to even get light where the past is concerned.
Yes, one of the interesting things about an expanding universe, and one of the ones that is almost poignant in a way, we now believe that the universe is not only expanding, but expanding faster and faster. And what that means is that in the far, far future, future astronomers, when they look out into deep space, the galaxies that we now see will have rushed so far away and be so quickly receding from us that they'll actually be receding faster than the speed of light. That's a strange idea to most people. Nothing goes faster than the speed
of light.
It's
almost inconceivable, really.
Well, yeah, well, we hear from childhood. Einstein said nothing goes faster than the speed of light. What Einstein actually said was nothing can move through space faster than the speed of light. He did not say that space itself couldn't expand faster than the speed of light. In fact, it can, which means that these distant galaxies will be moving away from us so quickly that we won't be able to see them. So future astronomers, when they look out, they're actually going to see deep, dark blackness out there in the far reaches of the cosmos. They're going to conclude that the universe is not expanding because there'll be nothing for them to see rushing away. So in a way, we can pretty much predict that future astronomers are going to be fooled by the cosmos into thinking that the universe is static, the kind of image that Einstein had in mind that we know to be wrong.
We've been fooled for a long time, haven't we, about, well, many things, but dark matter, for example.
Sure. We have recognized, actually, since the 1930s, that what we see out there in the cosmos is not all that there is. Because when we look at the motion of stars and galaxies, they're moving too quickly to hold together if only matter giving rise to gravity is the matter that's giving off light. It's like if I spin a bicycle wheel and I have water on the rim, the water's going to fly off if the wheel turns too quickly. Similarly, stars and galaxies should be flinging off into the cosmos because of the motion, unless there's some dark stuff out there not giving off light that is supplying additional gravity that's holding everything together. So we now believe that something like 25% of the weight of the universe is composed of this dark stuff. We don't know what the dark stuff is. We're searching now to try to figure it out, but we don't know the answer.
Our guest is Professor Brian Greene. His new book is called The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. And in Stephen Hawking's newest book, he talks about the possibility or likelihood that gravity preceded the Big Bang, at least this one Big Bang. As you point out in your new book, many, many Big Bangs may have occurred. But what does it mean for Hawking, it meant I'm an atheist. And I'm just thinking about how Einstein was such a singular mentor to you. I mean, you're even a vegan. He was a vegetarian. I don't know if that's connected. But I was thinking about how Einstein always believed in the symmetry of the universe, and therefore there must be some kind of power beyond. How do you see things?
Well, I could be wrong in interpreting Einstein's words. But whenever he would speak of God or the Old One, you know, this sort of reference, it was pretty much this kind of pantheistic notion that there is some kind of order to the universe, and he would ascribe that order to this notion of a divine being. But I don't think he had in mind the traditional notion. I think he was really more referring to the fact that it all holds together in some wonderful, coherent manner. And that's my view, too. If one wants to call the coherence of the universe God, I'm okay with it. But to me, it's really the laws of physics. It doesn't mean that there can't be a traditional divine being that started it all off and is perhaps guiding things in its evolution. I don't see any need for it. And to me, there's a singular wonder that a handful of equations may actually be behind it all.
Let's talk about that wonder, because certainly you've been a major advocate for science education. You're an educator. President Obama, in his recent State of the Union speech, talked about new programs for math and science. I just recently had occasion to do, in fact, an event for ARCS, the organization that provides scholarships for young science aspiring students, and she's a Nobel laureate in the life sciences. She was thrilled by this. You too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I firmly believe that the future, not just of America, which is where a lot of the focus is, I consider the future of the world relies on having the next generation of kids excited about science, viewing science as the most exciting place to put their energy, to put their talents. And I think, you know, books like this, which are definitely talking about the cutting edge of ideas that may or may not be correct, but you know, you talk to a young kid about the possibility of there being hidden realities, of there being other universes beyond ours, and I've seen kids light up their eyes, open their eyes in a way that they're like, wow, that's the kind of stuff that we can talk about as scientists? Yes, we can. There's also more concrete things that are valuable to focus your attention on, new energy sources, you know, building new kind of engines that we can burn fuels more cleanly and so forth. All of that is vital, vital stuff. But the possibility that science can really speak to the nature of reality, that can touch you in a very deep way.
It touches you, obviously, in a deep way. Would you be doing the science anyway? I mean, if you weren't a professor, do you think? Or if you weren't writing books, you would just be compelled by the play, by the creativity of it, by the compulsion of it?
Yes. You know, I didn't go into science thinking that I would spend part of my time bringing science to the public, but I found that when I was working on string theory in the 1990s, that people would get so excited to listen, even in an informal setting, to some of the ideas that we were coming upon, the possibility of extra dimensions, the possibility of these little vibrating filaments, and it became clear to me that the resistance that some of us feel toward science comes not from the science itself. It comes from being intimidated by the fact that the science is developed in the language of mathematics, which is just a language, and many of us don't speak the language of mathematics. So we need a translator that can go from the math to ordinary language in a way that the ideas become clear.
You see yourself as a translator.
In a way, I do. Yeah. That's really what it is.
What you also do is you provide metaphors, which is a good way to translate. One of my favorites, I must tell you, is that one about the Rastafarian hair with electromagnetic.
Yeah.
We're talking to Brian Greene, by the way, his new book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. You can join us. In fact, if you'd care to, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your calls, our emails, our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, available now, 866-733-6786. And we do, as I said, welcome your involvement in this conversation we're having with Brian Greene. 866-733-6786, or send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment. Let's talk a little bit about time with you, because time, you say, is not what we think time is.
That's right. Most of us have a sense of time where we are dragged inevitably from moment to moment to moment into the future. And the sense from our intuitive experience is that that's the same for everyone, regardless of what they're doing or where they are. And one of the deep insights of Einstein was that that's not the case. If, for instance, you are moving relative to me and I'm looking at your clock will tick off time at a slower rate than my watch is ticking off time. An unexpected idea. If you are hanging out near the edge of a black hole, then the strong gravity of the black hole slows your passage through time as well. So if you spend an hour near the edge of a black hole, careful not to cross over the edge where you won't be able to get out, but if you spend some time near the edge of the black hole and then you come back, say, to Earth, an hour on your watch may have been years, tens, thousands of years on the clocks on Earth. So it's a very different notion of time where it's more in the eye of the beholder, if you will, than some universal conception that applies to everything.
And if you're standing still, you're not really standing still.
Well, that's an important part of relativity, too. When you're standing still in the conventional sense, you are moving through time. And Einstein really emphasized that you need to think about time as another dimension of the universe. You know about three dimensions of space, you know, left, right, back, forth, up, down, that we all know about.
And now we're moving toward 11?
Well, string theory does add to that picture in a substantial way by imagining that there could be as many as 10 dimensions of space, seven of which we haven't directly seen. This is something that comes out of the math and something that might be testable at the Large Hadron Collider. It's a long shot, but this kind of stuff may be within reach of experimental verification.
I thought we were at the number 11 now.
11 if you
include time. On
the
precipice of 11.
That's correct.
11 is time would be included.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Wasn't it, and I don't know how his name is pronounced. Remember the old Superman comic books, Mr. Mobliflix, who came from the, what was it, the eighth dimension?
I think I missed
dimension?
That one.
Oh, well, you go back and learn a great deal from comic books like I did as a child, part of my formidable education. I mentioned in the billboard that GPS is tied to relativity. How is that so?
That's true, too. So a GPS system, how does it work? Well, we have satellites orbiting the Earth that are in communication with your GPS device. And how do they figure out where you are? Well, light signals are sent back and forth, and we time, the satellites time, how quickly it takes for the light to get bounced back. That's how they figure out your distance from one or the other satellite. Those satellites are in motion, and they're also high up, so they're not experiencing the same gravitational pull that we here have on Earth, which means that their clock ticks at a different rate, as I was saying, than the Earthbound clocks. If you don't take into account the rate at which their clocks tick off time differently because of general relativity, they will not accurately predict where you are. So if you didn't take into account general relativistic corrections, GPS systems would quickly become inaccurate. So in a sense, your GPS device that you can hold in your hand, in your iPhone, it is a nugget of general relativity that you're holding in the palm of your hand.
You know, you mentioned being a translator and interpreter for turning these rather complex ideas into something palatable for the public. And of course, Sagan was really a pathfinder and a great pioneer in that sense. And many people to this day continue to see you as fitting into those shoes or whatever metaphor you want to use here. How do you regard Sagan?
Oh, he definitely is a hero of mine. When I was at Cornell, you know, as a professor, as you were saying, back in the 1990s, he was still there, and I really wanted to meet him. And one day, I was jogging along, and he was going into a house that he was having built, and I was like, let me just hang out outside, and I can just meet him when he comes back. And he came back, and I was too intimidated to say anything, and he got in his car, and he drove away. So actually, I never met him, but definitely was a hero of mine.
That's a sad story in a way. I mean, it's a little poignant because you wanted to meet your hero and didn't. You're talking about children and children's education and how important it is to you. That was what compelled you to write a children's book?
Yes. You know, I have kids now, and I begin to watch them explore the world. And it's clear that kids are little scientists from the get-go. That's completely clear. And I think that kids can have their minds open to some pretty deep ideas at an early age if it's framed in a manner that's accessible to them. So I wrote this story, Icarus at the Edge of Time, which is about a rewriting of the traditional myth of Icarus, where now the boy doesn't build wax wings and fly near the sun. He builds a spaceship and he flies near a black hole, again defying his father. And the theory of general relativity kicks in and dictates how the story progresses as he goes to the black hole. So by virtue of following a narrative, a kid can at least get a feel for some of these strange features of time and general relativity.
Your dad was composer.
My dad was a composer, yes,
yeah.
And a vocal coach.
And so, to some extent, music became an important part of your formative. I just wonder about all these analogies and all these connections that have been made since ancient times between music and math. You see them?
I do, in the sense of pattern. I mean, mathematics and physics, it's all about pattern, trying to find patterns in the universe and encapsulate those patterns in mathematical equations. That's really what we do as physicists. Composers are also seeking out pattern. It's a different language. It's the language of notes, but finding interesting patterns that will move us in some particular way. So in that sense, there's a deep analogy between the two.
And physics moves you.
It does. And I think I just wish more people were moved by physics. You know, when you're talking about the beginning of time, the beginning of the universe, when you're talking about the possibility of other universes, when you're talking about the weird nature of reality that comes out of quantum physics, to me, it makes my heart flutter. I know it may sound silly, but it really does when I encounter these ideas and don't just view them as some interesting abstract intellectual exercise. When I view them as this is what's really happening, it's just mind-blowing.
We're talking to Brian Greene. His heart will continue to flutter as we bring your calls into it, and I hope that you will join us. Lines are full, but when one becomes available, feel free to take it. It's 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or join us by our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I should mention I'm going to be with Brian on stage tonight at the Herbst Theater. I'm afraid it may be sold out. It probably is, but there it is. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Brian Greene, as opposed to Brian Austin Green. Do you get any of that kind of stuff?
Not much, no.
Not much. I wouldn't think so. Not from the crowd that follows you. He's a physicist and popular science writer, and we're exploring the possibilities with him that we're not alone in our universe. That's what he writes about in his new book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes, and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. And he explains the various theories of multiverse, the hypothetical set of multiple possible universes. What might an alternative universe look like?
Well, a concrete example comes from thinking about the Big Bang. Most of us know of the Big Bang as a theory of how our universe started real small and went through a rapid expansion that allowed matter to coalesce into stars and galaxies. But the little secret about the Big Bang that we don't emphasize as much as we should is that the Big Bang leaves out the bang. It does not tell us what happened at time zero to actually cause that outward swelling to occur in the first place. So we've been working hard to fill in that gap. And we have a theory. It's called inflationary cosmology. Name's not all that important. But it fills in that gap. It tells us what caused the universe to undergo the swelling. But here's the thing. When we study the math, we learn that the Big Bang in this approach is likely not a one-time event. It's an event that can occur many times at various and far-flung places throughout a wider cosmos, each Big Bang giving rise to its own universe, our universe just being the result of one of those Big Bangs. The other universes could have different particles, different forces, different properties. You can think of it like a big giant cosmic bubble bath, if you will. Our universe being one bubble in this big collection of other bubbles, other universes.
You also use this metaphor of a big loaf and looking like Swiss cheese.
That's a Swiss cheese is a nice way of thinking about it too. I like that metaphor. The idea being that the holes in the Swiss cheese would be all of the different universes that you or I, we're in one of those holes, and the cheesy part is expanding.
Like not to sound cheesy, but you might be interviewing me in another alternative.
That's right? How it would go in some of these, because with so many possible universes, all of the possible outcomes compatible with the laws of physics could occur. And certainly me interviewing you would be compatible, I think, with the laws of physics, so it could be happening out there.
One thing that's not compatible with the law of physics is people, unfortunately, not having available tickets tonight because the event is sold out with as part of City Arts and Lectures and the science program that they have. We're going to go to your calls here, and let me begin with Richard from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air with us. Hi. Are you going to speak, or have we lost you?
Can you hear me?
Now I can. I couldn't before, but go ahead. Some particles didn't get through there. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, and my question is about particles. Professor Green, I have been waiting years to ask you this question since I read your Elegant Universe, and it occurred to me that the coil dimensions could possibly relate to each other such that, for example, if I defined a space-time point here in Lancaster, it might interact in some of the other dimensions with a space-time point in Alpha Centauri in unknown ways. And I'm wondering if this is a possibility that could underlie, you know, ideas of action at a distance that they tried earlier, you know, in centuries ago to, you know, resolve with the cosmic ether.
Yep, it's a very interesting idea, because since string theory does require extra dimensions, one could imagine, as you're suggesting, that two points that we think of as being far apart in three dimensions, maybe in some sense they're close together if you take into account the other dimensions. In detail, it is hard to make that idea fully work. You can imagine that the universe might be folded in on itself. So for imagine, take a piece of paper. The two opposite corners of a piece of paper look like they're far apart. They're on opposite ends of the page. If you fold the page over, however, you can bring those two corners close together in an additional direction, just the gap between the two of them as you fold the paper up. That's possible. But just to imagine that the extra dimensions alone can bring two points together, it's a little hard to make that work, because for two points to be close together, they need to be close together in all the dimensions.
And we thank you so much for the call. Glad he got that question you after all these years. Let's bring some more calls in with questions or comments, and Ramin is next. Hi, Ramin.
Good morning. Good morning, Professor Green. It's an honor to be able to ask you this question. My question is going to be about the concept of time and that how the axis of time seems to be very unique in physics, in that you can't go back and forth in it easily versus our other three dimensions that we relate. So what would happen if we attempt to eliminate this axis of time and replace it with the concept like a tempo, where a very fine cosmic clock is running basically gigantic state machine, and if we attempt to explain things that way, would we be able to even eliminate the need for infinity?
Well, I can give it a shot. I didn't fully understand the question, but certainly time is incredibly mysterious. And you're right. It is that we have a time axis that does seem to behave very differently from the three space axes or the 10 space axes, if you take string theory seriously. In the spatial directions, we can freely migrate left, right, back, forth. We can do anything we want, whereas the time dimension seems so much more constrained. We can go to the future in the way that we were discussing with relativity, but going to the past seems really hard. Can we change things so that time can be navigated more easily? I don't know. I don't see a way that's compatible with all we know about the universe, but it's a very mysterious subject. I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of it.
Well, I think when I had your colleague on from NOVA, Neil Tyson DeArcy, he said there are new frontiers that we need to explore, and that seemed to be the answer to so many of these questions, at least at the present. Here's a listener from Hillsburg, Lynn, who says, I think this goes back to the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and as I recall, it was sung as if it were a Gregorian chant. Time exists so that everything doesn't happen at once. Space exists so that everything doesn't happen to you.
John Wheeler, great physicist, is usually given credit for time is that which allows things to not all happen at the same time. Maybe the Smothers Brothers took it from him. I don't know. Or maybe he took it from them. Boy, that would be a nice twist.
There's definitely a graduate student paper there. Here's Thomas who says, how do you answer the criticism of string theory is akin to Ptolemy's celestial spheres? If one makes a sufficiently complex model of the universe, it might provide reasonably close predictions without actually having any real relationship to the underlying physics.
Well, first of all, we don't know that string theory is right. So the last thing I want to do is be out here saying string theory is right and Ptolemy is wrong. That's not the distinction I'd want to draw. But when you study the mathematics of string theory, it is a very elegant, it is a very economical and powerful synthesis of theories that came before. It may seem complicated because you have to introduce these new ideas of extra dimensions, and that kind of makes your mind hurt. But when you look at the mathematics of string theory, it is actually a very simple, refined approach to describing the small, the big, and maybe everything in between.
The micro, the macro.
Yes, it's all there. And the wonderful thing about string theory, and maybe people don't fully appreciate this, if you started with the equation of string theory, which is very simple, you can write it sort of on a single piece of paper, and you didn't know about general relativity. Let's say Einstein didn't exist or something, some alternate history, alternate universe. And you start analyzing the equation of string theory, you would derive Einstein's general relativity from string theory. That's a very powerful fact.
I mean, you start with string theory, you wind up with E equals MC squared.
Yes, it would come out of it, exactly. And that's not the case with Ptolemy. Ptolemy was just adding new levels of complexity to an existing theory. String theory is a new approach that can re-derive everything in the past and perhaps go forward.
Here's a listener who says, what's the source of energy that causes strings to vibrate?
I don't know. It's a good question. For some reason, the universe that we live in has energy, and if string theory is correct, the strings are the microscopic carriers of that energy, the most refined constituents of that energy. But why there's something rather than nothing, which is in essence what that question is, I don't know, and I don't think anybody does.
Max writes, what are the consequences for the human race if we achieve a verifiable, provable, unified field theory? What are the consequences for physicists? Do we all just go play golf and drink mint juleps? And beyond the emotional and psychological ramifications, what are the practical consequences? What can we actually do with the big answers?
Well, I give two thoughts on that. If we finally do have the unified theory and we prove it, is that the end of physics? No, it ends a certain chapter of physics, the search for the deep equations, but then you use those equations to understand everything in the cosmos far more deeply. You know, Richard Feynman, great physicist, he really said it best. He said, you know, when you learn the rules of chess, is chess over as a game for you? No, it's just beginning. Now you can use those rules to play all sorts of strategies and really get into the game. That's what we're doing. We're learning the rules of the universe. When we learn them, the game's not over. It's really just beginning.
You think Bernard Shaw was right? He said chess was infinitely more interesting than sex. You don't have to
do
answer
I have
that.
To answer that?
No. Brian Green with us is the author of The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. This is a listener who asks, how does your guest evaluate New Age gurus using quantum physics theory to justify psychic phenomena?
I'm not a great fan of that use of quantum physics. Quantum physics does say a lot of strange things, but it doesn't say any idea that just comes to mind is true. I do find, and I don't mean to disparage a whole area by any means, but I have encountered some people who basically say, quantum physics is weird. This other New Agey stuff is weird. Since quantum physics is weird and true, the New Agey stuff is weird and true, and that's too quick, much too quick.
Have you read Fritjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics? You give any?
I've thumbed through it. I can't say that I've really gone through it in enough detail to comment, but there are implications of quantum physics that are relevant and useful to thinking about reality. So I don't want to disparage that at all. The question is, have you made too big a leap when you start to apply these ideas to, say, the human mind and consciousness? I mean, to me, consciousness, the brain, is the most fascinating frontier that we will ultimately be able to explore. But the brain is this complex organism inside our heads, so many particles. We have difficulty in physics describing a mere handful of particles with complete accuracy. To try to apply quantum physics to the brain is so far beyond what we can actually do in practice that I'm always reluctant when any conclusion says, oh, something in the brain is due to quantum physics. I'm not saying it isn't, but I don't know how to bridge that gap myself.
Well, speaking of brains, can you give us a kind of easy definition of B-R-A-N-E, brains?
Yes, that's another kind of brain.
I think it's very funny that we talk about P-brains.
Yes.
Won't necessarily go there, but yeah, what... just getting into that concept and understanding.
Yes, this is another one of the multiverses that I discuss in the book that comes out of string theory. And what we've learned in the last decade in string theory is that the math doesn't say that these little vibrating filaments that I was describing are the only entity in the theory. The math also allows brain, membrane-like entities, which are two-dimensional extended objects like a big flat rubber sheet, or three brains. We take the word membrane, we take off the mem, and we put a three in front to say a three-dimensional object, or a four brain, or a five brain. These are all ingredients in string theory. Now, the reason why this is fascinating, it suggests a new way of thinking about the cosmos. Our universe may be taking place on one of these brains, a three brain. It's very hard to picture, so let me use a two-dimensional analogy that gets all the ideas. Think of a two brain as a big slice of bread. Then all that we've long thought to be the universe may be taking place on that slice of bread, and there may be other slices of bread filling out a larger cosmic loaf, other parallel universes that would be out there. This is the brain world approach to string theory.
And we go to more of your calls. Let's go to William next. William, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is this. What evidence, experimental evidence, visually recordable evidence from the Large Hadron Collider would support the string theory, and also what is the relation of space to string theory? Is space under string theory, is space then a particular kind of vibration, or just what is it?
So in terms of the kinds of evidence that we'll be looking for at the Large Hadron Collider that might support string theory, there are a few things. One is the real name of string theory, super string theory. And the super and super string theory refers to something called supersymmetry. It's a little technical, but the implication is something that we can all understand. According to supersymmetry, for every known particle in the world, electrons, quarks, neutrinos, there should be a supersymmetric partner particle. For the electron, it's called the supersymmetric electron or the selectron. For quarks, squarks, neutrinos, sneutrinos. I don't name these things, but this is what they've been called. And the idea is, according to the math, these particles should exist, but we've never seen them. And we believe it's because they're heavier than their cousins, selectrons heavier than the electrons. And that means you need a very powerful accelerator to smash particles together at very high energy to have a chance of producing these sparticles. So we will be looking for those sparticles in the collisions between protons at the Large Hadron Collider. Another interesting piece of experimental evidence would be this. We're looking for the extra dimensions. When proton against proton, when they slam into each other, if some of that debris drifts off of our brain into the other dimensions, that would be evidence by virtue of missing energy signatures that we are living on a brain and that there are other dimensions and possibly other brains out there.
That's where I read a lot of your excitement vested at this point.
Well, I think this is the approach. One thing that really needs to be underscored. String theory is absolutely hypothetical, unconfirmed. Interesting mathematics hasn't made contact with data. The multiverses that I describe in the book, they are not confirmed. Fantastically compelling ideas, but until they receive experimental support, how can we believe it? The brain multiverse, I think, is the one multiverse proposal that really stands a chance, long shot though it may be, of receiving some experimental input in the next few years. That's very exciting.
Let me thank the caller and move to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Harvey. Good morning.
Michael, thanks for the show. And hello, Brian. I've combined two theories, and I was just wondering what you think of them. I call it quantum telepathy. And according to Nick Herbert, when you have two objects or quantum interconnectedness, quantum entanglement, that's when you have two objects that are close to each other, and once they're separated, no matter what the distance, they seem to know, or something happens to one, the other one seems to know it or react. And I'm wondering, I also watched some YouTubes with Rupert Sheldrake talking about telepathy, and he said telepathy is between people and animals who know each other, like you and your dog, or you and your mother, your sister, your brother. And so when people get that feeling, the telephone call is going to be from their mother, then the phone rings. So that's like a form of telepathy. And I'm wondering if quantum physics and telepathy tie in there, because it's both the familiar objects that are intertied, and here it's the familiar people that get the telepathic messages from each other. So it's quantum telepathy. What do you think of that?
Well, I spend a lot of time thinking about quantum physics, less time thinking about telepathy, I have to tell you. I certainly don't know how to link the two. I do understand roughly what you're saying. In quantum physics, we do have this experimentally confirmed fact that particles can be entangled, they can be far apart and yet stay in quantum communication in an unexpected way. That's very surprising. But how do you go from that to the way in which minds might work between human and human or human and animal? I have no idea. And I don't think anybody in the world really does either. So I don't know that you can draw these links that are analogous, yes, but I don't think you can make any real statements of the sort that would satisfy your interest.
Let me thank the caller. Harvey, thank you for that call. Here's a question you probably get a lot from a listener who says she's now reading Simon Singh, the book on the Big Bang. Made me want to ask the question, what can we expect happening in a parallel universe? Will I find a copy of myself there?
One of the parallel universe proposals that I describe in the book, in fact, the simplest one, I think, would have that kind of a feature. If the universe, the spatial part of the universe, if it goes on infinitely far, then actually that's one of the conclusions that you reach. I'll tell you why. In any finite region of space, it turns out that, as I describe in the book, quantum physics establishes that matter can only arrange itself in finitely many different configurations. The analogy I like to use is if you have a deck of cards, you can shuffle it, you get different orders, but only finitely many different orders. So if you shuffle that deck enough times, say infinitely many times, the orders have to repeat. Similarly, if space goes on infinitely far, then the matter configurations will have to repeat sooner or later too. And matter configurations, well, that's what we call reality. So you and I having this conversation, the caller calling in with a question, that's just a configuration of particles. So if matter repeats, then the configuration repeats, then we're having this conversation out there in various guises in this enormous universe.
But there again, as I said to you at one moment in a conversation off air, when I was a kid, I was very taken by the phrase, life as we know it. There may be life utterly as we don't know it.
Oh, absolutely.
I can't even imagine it.
Yes, again, the point of the matter is, matter, when I say it has finitely many configurations, those configurations could look like us. It could look like some other form of life. It could, most of the time, look not like life at all. Most of these other universes would be lifeless, I think, because I think matter has to be arranged in a very, very precise configuration to give rise to anything that we would call life. But you're right, it doesn't have to be life as we know it.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll take the next call from Menlo Park. Steve, join us. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I was just wondering if Dr. Green has ever heard of Alexander Mayer and his theory, which is that there is no Big Bang and that the universe is, was, and always will be.
I don't know that gentleman. There is a famous theory, the steady state theory.
There's also somebody emailed us, the plasma cosmology of the Big Bang never happened, a book by Eric Lerner.
Sorry, I don't know either of those, but the evidence for the Big Bang is overwhelmingly strong. When we look out into space with powerful telescopes, we see the heat left over from the Big Bang. The Big Bang was a very, very dense, hot state of the universe. And you know, when things expand, they cool off. And the universe, as it expanded, cooled off. We can use our math to figure out how much it's cooled off. We look out into space, hang on, and we measure the temperature of the radiation in space, and it agrees with the calculations. Not even slightly. It agrees to 5 decimal places. The math of the heat and how it should vary from place to place in space agrees with the observations and the calculations to 5 decimal places. I haven't seen that kind of agreement in any other approach to cosmology. That's why it's so impressive.
Mayer says that that's due to redshift and that it's not due to the expanding universe. And he goes on to, you know, prove it mathematically.
Yeah.
I'm not a physicist, so I can't really quote it.
Yeah, I've never seen any approach that is able to describe the data with the precision that we do in the Big Bang or the inflationary version of the Big Bang theory.
Okay. Thank you
for the call. Here's a listener, Carmine, who says, if a black hole compresses matter to nothing, are there new universes at the other end wherein the rules are different?
This hasn't been a suggestion that's come out of physics. Even from the time of Einstein, we've known, at least mathematically, you can have a black hole, and at its center, in some sense, another universe can sprout out from it. Whether or not this is how things really work is beyond what we can ascertain today. It requires understanding how quantum processes would work right at the center of a black hole. We hope string theory will one day allow us to do those calculations, but even string theory is stymied to really understand what happens at the very center of a black hole, so we don't know.
We go to more calls, and let's bring Bill into this. Bill, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Oh, hi. Yeah, well, the screener I told one question to, but Dr. Green just sort of got my gall about the Big Bang. The biggest argument against the Big Bang is that there's no accounting for the absence of the antimatter. So, and the other big problem is this arm waving about the inflationary part. The universe has to expand at two different rates to account for the temperature similarity at the opposite ends of the universe. So, but anyway, my question really has to do with the complexity of matter. When physicists first started determining the how matter is composed in the universe, it seemed like it was getting simpler and simpler. You know, first we had atoms, and then we had protons, electrons, and neutrons. And then all of a sudden, when we started looking deeper, we started getting, I don't know, is it 12 different kinds of quarks and mesons and supersymmetry particles. And for some reason, it seems like this is much too complex for the universe to create all these multitude of particles. And so I'm wondering, does this thing, string theory, account for the universe creating, you know, one thing that all these others derive from?
Yes, that's one of the main motivations for string theory. We have a very powerful theory. It's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics that does describe with great accuracy the particles that the caller is talking about, the quarks, the electrons, the neutrinos, and so forth. But the problem with that theory is it has a whole lot of particles in it and a whole lot of undetermined parameters. String theory goes beyond that and allows us to describe them all in terms of vibrating strings. So that's the hope. That will simplify things dramatically with this new approach.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Brian Green. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's bring on Tim. Tim, you're on.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Assuming that all theories begin with assumptions, my question is, what do physicists assume about dark matter? For instance, do you assume that it must exist within the same universe or dimension as ours, that it's the same nature as visible matter, that its particles made up of vibrating strings, does it have the same uneven soap bubble type structure, and so forth? What are the assumptions that you're making?
Well, we're open to most of the possibilities that you're suggesting. The simplest assumption is that it's made up of particles whose identity we've yet to determine, and those particles are simply floating in space in a fairly uniform manner. That approach seems to be able to describe the data well, and it would suggest all we need to do is capture some of those particles in a detector and determine what they are. And that's what many experimental scientists around the world are trying to do. The more exotic possibility, one of the ones that you mentioned, is that maybe the dark matter is in a parallel universe, and this has been explored too. This loaf of bread, this brain multiverse that I was describing from string theory, well, you could imagine that if there's another brain, another slice of bread right next to ours, exerting gravity on us, maybe that's where the additional gravity comes from. And the reason we don't see the matter giving rise to it is because we can't see off of our brain. One of the features of string theory is that photons, light, the way we see, would be trapped on our brain. It would move only along our slice of bread. We could not look off of our slice of bread. So the matter would be there, but it would be dark. That is a possibility, exotic, but one that people are considering.
A related question coming from one of our listeners named Joe, who says, with all this talk of dark matter affecting the weight of galaxies, No one seems to ever mention that we haven't yet seen this stuff or directly observed black holes at that. Is anyone looking into new theories of gravity that may take the observations into account without the addition of dark matter?
Absolutely. That's another approach. Maybe our mathematical laws need adjusting as opposed to adjusting the constituents of the universe. And there is something called modified Newtonian dynamics and various other approaches which have attempted to modify the equations without having to introduce dark matter or dark energy. They're interesting proposals.
There may indeed be, you know, I'm thinking about something like Euclidean geometry. I mean, there are non-Euclidean forms of geometry. There may be other forms of mathematics, correct?
That's an interesting possibility, which I struggle with. There are, of course, different assumptions you can make in mathematics. So the real question I struggle with, I was in a public debate once talking about this, and I said, I can imagine one day the aliens will come down and say, how have you been trying to figure out the universe? We show them our equations. They say, oh, math, we tried that for a while. It works for a bit, but it's a dead end. But how would you finish that? I don't know.
I'll get another caller on, and that's you. Lee, hi.
Hi. My question is, if time slows down as you approach the speed of light, and essentially it's, time stops when you, as you're at the speed of light, does that mean that a photon coming from a distant star takes no time at all to get to the Earth?
Well, in some sense, yes, but you need to take it with a grain of salt in the following sense. If you're asking for the time experienced by the photon itself, then in some formal sense, the photon doesn't age. But when we talk about the time it takes for the photon, we're talking about the time on our clocks as we're watching that photon traverse this great journey. So it's that time that really matters, and that's the one that is non-zero.
I thank the caller. Boy, we're out of time. There's so much more to talk about here with you. It's always an embarrassment of riches. So good to have you with us. Again, Brian Greene's new book is out and available, and it is The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to extend thanks to everybody who had something to do with today's program, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and we welcome Amy Machado here with us now. We also want to thank our engineer, Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.